Stay here and prepare our forces to descend immediately, one unit at a time. Navarre shut up and did as Elendine commanded, and the queen was grateful for her forbearance. Elendine called over the captain of the nearest peacemaker unit, and as Navarre began forming up the tiny army on the glass, the queen ventured down into the coolness with 12 peacemakers ranging out before her with lanterns, crossbows, and drawn swords. She descended several tens of steps. The underground space grew wider and wider. Her apprehension about whether her forces would fit evaporated. The scent of water sharpened, and the air grew even cooler. They found a subterranean forest of a sort. Instead of trees, great glass pillars stretched upward, trunks wider than any four humans could encircle, spreading away into a darkness that was lit here and there by glints of light from above. Dust, caught in the shafts, danced like fireflies. "Your Majesty," the lead peacemaker called, "over here." Joining the peacemaker, a man called Gali, the queen saw that he was squinting into the depths of a glass pillar. "What is it?" she asked. "I thought I saw someone moving within." Elendine resisted asking the peacemaker if he was certain. He wouldn't have wasted her time on anything less. "Describe it," she said instead, bringing her own lantern to bear on the surface. The light penetrated a few handspans, but the pillar grew milky and opaque. "I thought it was my own reflection at first," Gali said, "but then I realized the face was too thin and pale, the armor too ragged. Perhaps it was a rogue spirit." Some spirits didn't find their way to the court of sleep, but instead lingered on the surface. It wouldn't surprise her if a place as deadly as the glass desert was haunted by more than its fair share of the uneasy dead. If she had the ring of death. If dreams had wings, Elendine would fly back to Hazurium, strike the false regent's head from her shoulders, and ask her departed sister Flora to the royal veranda for sweet cakes and strong coffee. If. Instead, she said, "You're probably right, Gali. Keep watch. If seer spirits haunt this delve, they may grow unquiet when the rest of our forces descend. Or maybe they will flee so much attention." "Let's hope for the latter, Your Majesty," Gali said. Elendine arranged for another peacemaker to give Navarre the all-clear, so the first protector could bring down the host. She knew it was getting warm topside. Then she continued to press into the hollow. How big was it, really? 30 or 40 paces further in, she found a spring bubbling up to form a shallow pool. A stream slipped away from the pool, running down between sharp-edged glass boulders and reflective pillars. She directed the beam of her lantern to follow the stream's uneven path down. The phantom ring on her finger vibrated. The sensation was so unexpected she froze for a full second before jerking her hand into the light of the lantern. Her finger was bare. When her eyes came back up, she was looking directly into the empty gaze of a grinning skull. No, it was a reflection in a glass pillar. The figure was standing behind her. Elendine spun to face the thing that had ambushed her. Nothing was there. "Lotan's hoary nethers," she cursed. When she snapped her glance back to the glass pillar, the skull was still there, and it had grown a hand that was reaching for her. She flinched away, and the thing's bony fingers, glowing with searing heat, grazed her. She felt the contact, smelled the burning metal of her breastplate, and a faint surge of heat. Yet she couldn't see it at all with her own eyes, only by its reflection. "Good enough," she grunted, unsheathing her sword. She swiped Renswandir through the air where the reflection told her the spirit should be. The runes on her blade flared gold as she struck something, and a suggestion of a shape briefly occupied the air before fading back to invisibility. A scream of rage followed, sepulchral for all that it aped the passion of life. shouts from the direction she'd come of peacemakers realizing their queen had gone forward without them followed. Fighting a foe you could only see by its reflection was damn difficult, she decided when she sidestepped into the thing's next burning touch instead of away. This time, the scent of burning material included skin, though it took a moment for the pain to follow. When it did, she almost dropped her sword. Suddenly, Gali was with her, eyes alight with alarm, searching for the foe she faced. "Look for its reflection," she yelled, and swung at the grinning spirit. Misjudging, her sword whistled through empty air. She checked the sheet of glass, frowning to see two more spirits fade into the image, one human and the other Keflum. They hissed, the sound like blowing sand. Elendine tried reason. "We are not seekers or soul sorcerers here to trap you. We're only shelter seekers, fleeing the noonday sun. I beg you, allow us to share the coolness for a span, and then we will be gone." The new spirits paused, looking uncertain if that was possible. But the original's reflection only laughed louder, hollow and echoing in the underground space. Where had it gone? Its reflection in the original sheet of glass had vanished. A searing line of pain drew itself down her back. She rolled forward, realizing the thing had positioned itself so she hadn't been able to see it in the glass. Thank the Maker her relic breastplate was light enough she could move as if unencumbered. The peacemaker Gali, standing further up the broken trail among the glass pillars, had a different vantage of the fight. He screamed, "I see you!" and lunged. From Elendine's perspective, his thrust cut emptiness, but the seer spirit's laughter choked off. When Gali withdrew his blade, a haze of spectral light flared around the steel, then dissolved to ash. The tortured spirit was sent to its rest, she hoped. Even if not, it wouldn't bother them for at least another revolution of the seven moons. She fixed her eyes on the remaining two spirits. Brandishing her fist, as if she yet wore the ring of death, she decreed, "Leave us, or your fate will prove the worse. I will erase you, I swear by the incarnation of death." A thrill of potency electrified her as she spoke, starting from her bare finger. The echo of the power she'd worn for so long seemed to reach from the past and give her words truth. The two remaining spirits fled as if blown away in a sandstorm. After a pause to make certain it wasn't a ruse, Elendine relaxed. She glanced at Gali and couldn't quite restrain a grin. "I think that's done it, then," she said. "My queen, it seems so." Navarre and a riot of peacemakers stampeded down the steps and surrounded her, blades drawn, eyes blazing with indignation and vigilance. Elendine could tell from Navarre's expression that she was furious, though she held her tongue. Probably only because Elendine and the First Protector were among her forces, and it would be unseemly. But the queen knew that she was in for a dressing down when they were alone next. Not that she didn't deserve it, of course. Shame threatened to warm her cheeks. She considered appointing the peacekeepers who followed the First Protector as the queen's personal detachment for the foreseeable future, just to put off the dressing down as long as possible. She didn't need to hear it. She already knew Navarre was right. "How fares the bivouac?" Elendine said. "The army is descending in good order," replied the First Protector, her ears flicking with annoyance. "I'm sure you can hear them, Your Majesty." Keflum gestured upward and back. True, clamor of a company banging and clanging its way above into the wide space was unmistakable. Voices issuing orders and boots on stone grew louder. She saw the yellow-orange glow of fresh lanterns shining blearily through the translucent columns. "Your Majesty," began Navarre. Damn it, Navarre wasn't going to wait until they were alone after all. Elendine held up a hand. "Later." "Please," she said. "I saw something odd as I rushed to defend you." "I know, Navarre, believe me. I trust you do understand the foolishness of your lone advance. You're not an imbecile, but that's not what I'm talking about. Ellendine blinked and cleared her throat. Havar was, of course, suggesting exactly the opposite. She ignored the jibe and said, "Then what?" she said. "When you commanded the spirits to leave, I'm certain I saw a flash. The same light I saw when we were beset by the moon door. You called on the ring of peace then to quell the Kray, and the band flashed." Ellendine well remembered that moment when she'd asked the serene stillness of death and froze, descending Kray seedlings before they touched her and her host. "But I don't have the ring anymore." She raised her hand to demonstrate and wiggled her bare fingers at the first protector. And yet, she looked more closely at her ring finger. She'd felt a phantom of the power the newly awakened ring had contained a few times. Was it possible? What she'd experienced was no mere memory? She concentrated, attempting to recall exactly how the sensation had come to her. She imagined the cool band encircling her finger. A cold tingle, real or imagined, she didn't try to determine, answered. Faint. Oh, so faint. But maybe something real. Like an umber wolf sneaking up on an oblivious pilgrim. She carefully examined the feeling. A ghostly voice floated across her of someone speaking. A man speaking. She didn't recognize the voice, yet it was familiar. As if something inside her had been waiting to hear it since forever. It whispered, "Come to me, rings of incarnation. It is I, your maker, who calls you. Return to me in my hour of need. If worn, then I command you, the wearer, to find me. The ring will know the way. If I speak instead to a mute band, find me. Find a wearer, and lead her or him to me." The message didn't repeat. But suddenly, certainty clutched Ellendine with a crystal clarity she hadn't felt about anything for far too long. She knew where the Maker was, and this time, she knew it wasn't a sham. It was no seeming or fraud. How she was able to discern it, she couldn't say. She just knew that this time, the Maker really had returned to Ardeen. And he was calling all of the rings of incarnation to him. Including the ring of peace, of death, the band that should be hers. No doubt the Maker had the power to force the betrayer to return the ring to its rightful owner, if she proved unable. But would the Maker return death to her if she made a claim? The only way to find out was to ask. She knew the way. For once, circumstance smiled upon her. He wasn't far. Chapter 27 Homecoming. Jason Cole. He lost sight of Merritt hours earlier in the insane boil of unzipping fractal solids and multicolored hues. The Kray still pursued him, though at a horrifyingly leisurely pace, as if they didn't actually want to catch him, which was fine by Jason, but his ability to move through the strange was gradually deteriorating. The place scraped his mind like sandpaper, which is why when the Dlam appeared out of nowhere, having circled back to look for him, a weight of tension and fear loosened his body. He was pretty sure the Kray hadn't already caught him up because they were just toying with him, not because they couldn't. He grabbed the pommel and pulled himself into the saddle. The Dlam spread its wings, and they surged with a velocity Jason could hardly hope to have matched. He was going to survive, after all, it seemed, no thanks to that bitch Merritt. The massed horde quickly fell from sight, lost in the sickening swirl. He didn't spend too long looking because it reminded him too much of staring into a suppurating wound. And yet, he still sensed the mass horde of Kray advancing. Even though they'd fallen completely out of sight, the feeling of their lingering presence remained. He hoped it was his imagination. "Thank you," he told the Dalai. "You have war's gratitude." It nodded. Maybe the Dalai had realized Jason needed help, not only in escaping the Kray, but also in finding the interface back to Ardeen. The translucent membrane was difficult to see out in the Strange, because the Strange was a fucking madhouse, and the interface was a mere blip in the maelstrom. He reminded himself the Strange didn't contain the land of the curse. Instead, it hosted it like a computer network hosted a program. As real as Ardeen sometimes seemed, this was the raw medium that gave it that semblance. Ahead, the empty space they'd been rushing toward suddenly contained a curved pane of hard glass, one they were about to smash directly into. When the Dalai winged onward and into it, he forced himself not to flinch. Firm pressure enveloped Jason, a giant fist squeezing every inch of him to fit into some more bounded, confined shape, one of rules, responsibilities, and hard consequences. The pressure eased and he blinked. Ardeen stretched before him, familiar and normal. The corners of his mouth tugged up. They soared over the borderlands from Ardeen's southern foot, just miles from his fortress of Mageddon. Even from this distance, he could see the sprawling walls, the tall ebony towers, and the searing volcanic extrusions tapped to power the foundries. Odd, he could see it all, actually. "I don't understand," he said. "Marid said that when we returned, it would be in the same location we left, which was in the borderlands west of her lair. Yet," he gestured at the scene ahead. The Dalai's shoulders gave a subtle shrug, and it surprised him by speaking. "I have skills Marid lacks. When it comes to traveling back and forth between Ardeen and the Strange, I can re-enter a recursion from the interface and come out almost anywhere I choose, if it lies along a specified boundary." Jason grinned. Allying with the Dalai continued to pay dividends. This creature aided him for inscrutable reasons of its own, not because it feared him. It had a spark of knowing that was lacking in others of its kind. It knew Ardeen was a world bounded by a much wider, stranger reality. It possessed skills that even he, once an incarnation of Ardeen, was still learning. Making it a pet or taking its aid for obedience would probably piss it off, and that would be the end of a beautiful friendship. Indeed, with the Dalai's help, perhaps he could finally deal with Marid, but only after he'd taken care of a few other things. For instance, blunt pain, like indigestion gone horribly wrong, stabbed through his bowels. Jason grunted in surprise. He could count on one hand the number of times he'd felt physical discomfort, even during his mostly mortal existence over the preceding 2 centuries he'd been trapped in Ardeen. He carefully rubbed his abdomen, checking for a stray spine or dart. Maybe a Kray or the dragon had managed to stick him in all the chaos. Nope. No visible wound or discoloration was visible. But still, he felt wrong, like he was going to be sick all over the Dalai's back. Jason tried to will the nausea away. He didn't have time to diagnose the problem. The sensation was probably related to his anxiety about the Kray Armada out there in the void, an armada that possessed the Ring of Silence, denied him. Without at least 4 rings, he would not be entering the Maker's Hall any time soon. The pain inside him gouged at his liver, and he winced. "You see it too, then," said the Dalai, misreading his physical reaction. Jason's eyes snapped to the towers over Mageddon. He realized that the pillar of dark smoke rising from the center of his fortress wasn't normal, not by half. He scanned, both visually and with his enhanced senses, trying to discern the cause of the disturbance. No dragon was present, thankfully, nor any Kray he could detect, not even seedlings. But something bad had happened, somewhere within his foundries, and someone new had come into his realm. his breath caught. That part of him that was war sensed a power that was familiar, from the days of old, from before the betrayal. "The ring of desire has returned to Mageddon," he murmured, uncertain. But how could that be? The closer they came, however, the more certain war became. Desire was back, somehow. Jason didn't know what to think. He hadn't made the Ring of Desire part of his plans moving forward after it served its purposes on Earth, which had been short-sighted given its evident return. But hell, he was willing to learn from his errors, as any good soldier did. In fact, the more he turned it over in his mind, the more Desire's surprising return augured that his plans could proceed apace without the Ring of Silence. Let the Kray have it. He wouldn't be lured out past the borderlines a second time. But how had the ring he'd repurposed to deliver quantum code on Earth returned to Ardeen? Was Desire's reappearance related to the pillar of smoke rising from his fortress? His gut said it was connected. Unless the Kray had got ahead of him, suggested the part of him that liked to dash his most cherished dreams. "Faster, damn you. I mean, please, go quickly as you can, my friend," he told the Dlama. The Dlama sped towards the brooding walls of his home, hopefully his home for only a little while longer, until he quit it and returned to Earth on his own terms. As they flew, Jason idly massaged at the lingering pain in his side. Something both better and far worse than he'd imagined had played out in the heart of Mageddon in his absence. Among the press of Reds stumbling mindlessly through the thick smoke around the edge of the pit reactor, no Kray hunted, which was a relief. But the heaped rubble and even thicker smoke spilling out of the contact foundry made Jason's heart jump into his throat. He bounded forward and passed through the smoke. "What the hell is going on in here?" he roared as he took in the disaster. Debris mixed with the corpses of his red homunculi were everywhere. Worse, Biter was a wreck of shattered crystals steaming noxious black vapor as they continued to disintegrate. A century of work obliterated. And the translation gate focus that had shimmered in the center of the chamber, the gate he'd managed to connect to Earth, was gone. The connection was severed. He got his breathing under control by rationalizing. It wasn't a complete disaster. He'd already accomplished his initial goal of bringing Earth back into sync with Ardeen. With that in place, moving between the locations should prove far easier, especially for someone like him. He just proved he could move between worlds hosted by the Dark Energy Network. Could the world of normal matter be that much more difficult to breach, now that it was synced? Not once he had taken the Maker's attributes for his own, he decided. Jason finally spied the intruders, a man and a woman standing still as statues over the dead body of one of Jason's lieutenants. He knew who they were. For fuck's sake, he'd actually puppeted the man around on Earth, which he'd temporarily entangled with the Ring of Desire using the entropic seed he'd gotten from the Kray. Raoul, the man pretended his name was, though that was a fucking lie. It was actually something like Earl Shun or some similar mouthful. When he'd possessed Raoul, Jason had seen into the man's mind. There he glimpsed an alien world called Ruck, the likes of which he could never even have imagined. Insane biotech science fiction craziness run amok. Raoul had warned him that Ardeen wasn't alone, and that war's plans wouldn't be allowed to succeed. And here, Raoul was. The man's threats hadn't been idle. He was obviously responsible for the destruction visited on Jason's fortress, which implied that maybe there was such a place as Ruck, twin to Ardeen in the Dark Energy Network. He decided not to worry about that complication just yet. Jason knew the woman, too. She'd been on Earth with Raoul. Aloud, Jason said, "Catherine Manners." She glanced at him, and holy shit, she was wearing the Ring of Desire. Shit! Shit! Did she know its full potential? Did she have any inkling of what she could do with it on her finger? Like all the other rings, it hadn't returned to full power, but he imagined a reasonable portion of its old strength had returned. He reached out to see if any of the entanglement created by the entropic seed remained, but that link was gone. "Jason Cole," Kate said, looking at him with wide eyes, scared eyes, which suggested she didn't know what the Ring of Desire could do after all. Relief made him smile. "Call me War," he told her. "Why'd you destroy my contact, Foundry?" Anger replaced the fear in her eyes and face. She sputtered, "Why? To save the world. Because you tried to leave Earth vulnerable against the Strange and the things that live there." As she spoke, Raoul from Ruck nodded along casually. But to War's trained eyes, the man was actually poised to go for Jason's throat. Raoul was dangerous, maybe even to an incarnation. Jason glanced around and saw a couple of reds he could call to his defense if it came to it. Or he could summon the Mantle of War and create a small unit of duplicates about as quickly. But either way, Jason, his homunculi and his duplicates would be vulnerable to Desire's will. Should she show forth that particular ring's mind-bending power? Desire's demands had always been War's biggest weakness. If half-remembered fragments of ancient memory could be believed. His regard dipped to the band on her hand against his will, then flinched away. Jason decided to play along a while longer and continue to assess the situation. He needed that ring off Kate's finger. "Endanger the Earth?" asked Jason. "Did Carter tell you that? He's brain-damaged by everything that's happened to him. He has it all wrong. If you're getting your intel from Carter Morrison, think again." "You're lying," said Kate. "Am I? Says who?" Raoul cleared his throat. "Says me. You're risking this recursion and Earth and Rock, plus every other limited world connected to Earth with your insane machinations. You do know that, right? Or are you actually ignorant of how excessive quantum computing attracts the attention of alien entities in the dark energy network?" Raoul curled his lip in contempt. "Fuck it." Jason smashed his elbow into the man's throat with bone-crushing force. Or he would have, if Raoul hadn't been ready for him, probably trying to elicit exactly such a response. Instead of crushing the man's larynx, and so resigning him to death by suffocation, Jason's elbow was slapped aside and down, pinned briefly across Jason's own chest. With the hand he wasn't using to restrict War's arm, Raoul stabbed at Jason with a scarlet-hilted short sword. Jason's own reflexes took over, and he shifted back and away, breaking the pin and evading the sword in one move. Surprisingly, Raoul didn't follow up. Instead, he speared Jason with amazingly clear eyes and said, "Wouldn't you rather just have a nice, comfortable rest? All this fighting, all this striving, is so tiring. Come on, let's call it quits and sit for a bit. What do you say?" For a half moment, the man's mental twist actually had the ghost of an effect. Luckily, the influence Raoul exerted fell far short of what would be needed to compromise War. But Jason pretended to go along with it anyway. He allowed his mouth to go slack, and his arms dropped to his side. He said, "You know, I am tired. Trying to take over the world isn't easy." Raoul nodded. "I can only imagine. Why don't you go over there and have a seat? Perfect place for a nap." He motioned towards the nearest wall. Jason made a show of yawning and took a few steps that way. Kate whispered to Raoul, "What are you doing?" The moment the man's attention shifted to his friend, War's mantle surged up in Jason like rising magma. He multiplied from a single figure into a company of dozens strong, each clad in ebony armor and wielding weapons that kindled to roaring flame. The intruders would pay for their insolence. In one voice, he and his company demanded, "Give up your ring or die." Their fingers pointed at Kate like ebony knives. "Oh, holy Jesus," Kate said, reflexively hiding her ring with her opposite hand. Raoul stepped in front of her, drawing a second short sword from his sheath. He held the blades with reasonable skill. Not that it was going to do him any good against war. Jason laughed. Or maybe it was war. Did it matter? The power of his incarnation was cresting again, and while basking in that mastery, failure was unimaginable. The ring of war glowed scarlet, brighter than he'd seen it since before the Maker's death, bathing his duplicates, the floor, Raoul and his swords, and even Kate, who cowered from the light's intensity. The band on Kate's finger flickered into a glowing life of its own, as if taking light from the fervor of his own mantle. Not red like blood splashed across the battlefield. Her light was violet. War remembered that color. The ring of desire emitted the hue of purity, lucidity, ambition, delight, and devotion. War frowned, understanding his tactical error. By invoking his own aura, he'd catalyzed the somnolent power in the mortal's ring. Power now rising into awareness. War had to deal with things immediately before Desire realized he'd just given her a human host. With as little effort as closing his fist, War launched his company into a charge. His soldiers fell on Raoul and Kate, burning weapons, slashing, crushing, and stabbing. Chapter 28 Desire. Catherine Manners. Kate was so terrified she thought she might be. Maybe she did, it didn't matter. She and Raoul were about to die. She'd sensed Jason's change before it happened, like a tsunami of invisible energy. As it rolled over him, Jason's expression and posture fell away, and the incarnation of war melded into his place, and he grew. Shadows fled from his presence. The scarlet light burning from his ring was more than illumination. It was the clang of steel on steel, of warriors screaming battle cries, and of soldiers dying on battlefields thousands of years ago. His soldiers, versions of him, called into being as she stared slack-mouthed, charged. They at least retained a human size, but there were so many. She scrabbled for the Asher. Without the spiritual cloak Darneth had provided, she felt naked. The soldiers crashed into Raoul. He deflected three attacks in a stunning display of swordsmanship. One duplicate fell and hazed away in a swirl of sparks, but at a cost. A red-hot blade sliced across Raoul's shoulder. A mace cracked his forearm, and a dagger protruded from his stomach, its hilt still burning with war's flame. Raoul screamed, staggering. "No! Stop!" Kate yelled. Her voice was a ring of violent radiance that swept away from her in all directions, and she stumbled. What? Dizziness swamped her. She went down on one knee, opposite hand slapping onto the tiled floor for balance. On that hand, her ring blazed. It was the source of the violet light and her dizziness. It was... Revelation bloomed. It was the fucking ring of desire. A window snapped open in her mind. Through it, years swept by. Of Ardeen when it was young, of the Maker and his incarnations, an incarnation such as herself. She was a physical manifestation of the seven rules of Ardeen, which kept Lotan the sinner bound. They'd struggled for millennia during the Age of Myth. Of course, how had she forgotten? She'd been like a god. It was beyond wonderful. But was it real? Dana Scully would prescribe Kate a hefty dose of anti-hallucinogens. Because no, of course it wasn't real. It was all a fiction given the guise of reality. Her lurking sense of disappointment whispered. It was. Raoul cried out, breaking Kate from her insane recollection. He was still fighting, protecting her while she crouched on the floor. Blood pooled on the floor beneath him. He staggered and groaned with each parry and sword thrust. But Half-War's duplicates had stopped moving completely, their eyes glowing not red with War's authority, but violet. Violet with clarity and devotion. To her. To desire. She knew they would do as she demanded, at least for a little while. But how? She let her fear of disappointment lapse, and the incarnation of desire's mantle swept over Kate. Everything was different. Pain, fear, uncertainty, loss, and most importantly, fear of disappointment, were transformed to various textures of glorious existence. When last desire walked, a newness had come into the land of the curse. War, the Maker, and some of her fellow incarnations were changed, gaining memories of other people from another world completely different than Ardine. Excitement at the prospect of learning more had inflamed her, then, though desire herself hadn't fused with the mind of a mortal host. She relished that change in the others, though anticipated what it might mean. Then War, who'd always been her favorite incarnation, murdered the Maker. Remembering the cut, the hot blood pouring from him, then nothing else until this moment soured desire's delight. Anger warmed her, though it was an emotion she felt so rarely that she hardly recognized it. It seeped up from the one named Kate, whose body desire manifested within. Anger burned away second thoughts and second guesses and scared mental voices like Kate's, making her certain. Here was War again. Once more sending his duplicates to slay, as he'd slain the Maker. Not again, vowed Desire. With a thought, she turned those duplicates of War she'd already bedazzled upon their fellows. The ones who'd been trying to hack through the swordsman's. Raoul's faltering sword defense turned and hurtled back toward their hulking master. Raoul sank to the floor, gasping and bleeding. Desire raised her voice and said to War, "Why did you forsake me, darling?" War froze, avoiding looking directly into her eyes. He was vulnerable to her, but he knew it. He wasn't an idiot. More was the pity. Instead of answering her directly, the incarnation clenched his fist and threw off another company of duplicates that smoked out of him, hornets from a kicked nest. She sensed the minds of War's army kindling as they formed, each merely a clipping of War's complete consciousness, which was why they were even more susceptible than their progenitor. The incarnation of War, for all his defenses, had a soft spot for her. Everyone did, but War in particular had willingly set aside his defenses on more than one occasion during their long struggles. She'd welcomed him then, as she welcomed his army now, with arms wide and a smile like an amethyst sun and the smell of lilac. More than half instantly came under Desire's influence, and she wasn't even trying. Her own glamour, dizzied Desire, swept her up and made her laugh in delight as fighting ignited in War's ranks, soldier falling upon soldier. The emotions they generated belied her knowledge that the duplicates weren't fully real. When they killed each other, the cold, sharp stab she sensed was almost the same as when a normal Ardener perished, except no spirits came free of the duplicates' flesh, and their bodies dissolved moments later like fleeing fireflies. The mind they possessed cast no shadow in the afterworld. Which was why Desire felt only a tug of remorse when she commanded each new wave of soldiers War hatched to kill their brothers. "I can keep this up all day, darling," she told him, betraying no hint of that minor regret. He pretended not to hear her over the clamor. She knew her words had registered. War's sole reaction was to spawn yet another company and hurl them toward her. Desire smiled indulgently. He'd always been headstrong. "War," she said, "you can't win me back by showing off. You never could. Remember our time in the green wilds?" She called up the sweet memory and projected it with another violet wave. Every one of the duplicates and War himself paused to recall those golden hours so long ago. Memories of most creatures grow cold and shift with time's passage. Not so for Desire. Hers grew only more grand and magnificent as time marched on. War groaned, struggling to hold on to his army and losing. 2-1, they turned on him. "Lotan, take you," War hissed. He dissolved his traitor army with an angry slash of his fiery staff. "That's no way to greet a lover," she said. "Even one that you spurned." War glanced at her, and finally, deliciously, their gazes locked. War stood long strides from Desire, but she could see his eyes. He certainly saw hers. She only had one chance at this, and Desire didn't intend to waste her opportunity adding War to her retinue. Already his pupils were larger than normal, but as the moments passed and they stood unmoving, regarding each other, the dark circles expanded. He was coming fully under her spell. Already she doubted he remembered his own name. Soon he wouldn't be more than... Desire and Kate both blanched when Raoul's life snuffed out. All deaths saddened Desire, but for Kate, it was like being kicked in the stomach. Desire's mantle shredded and was gone. "Raoul!" Kate sobbed, spinning away from War. She rushed to the crumpled body. "No, no, no, please!" The incarnation's easy mastery of exotic minds and wills, even those of the dead, was gone with her ring's mantle. But Kate retained the sensitivity to spirit she'd gained when she'd taken on the context of a shepherd when entering Ardeen, a shepherd of the dead. Darneth had been her sole charge, and she'd lost him. Now Kate sensed that same tentative energy before her that Darneth had demonstrated, a gray cloud on the edge of blowing away. Rather than a forgotten warrior of some previous age of Ardeen, it was Raoul. She could feel the man's identity in the memory of his ephemeral eyes. "Can you hear me?" The vague shape ceased its slow dispersal. "Raoul," she asked it, "stay with me." A man's face smoothed out of the rough smoke around the eyes. Raoul's face. He blinked, colorless. His hands moved, effectless. But she could hear him. He said, "Where am I? It's so cold." "You saved me," she said, "from War's army." Which was true as far as that went. If he hadn't intervened, the very first charge of duplicates would have cut her into so many bloody ribbons. After that, though, Kate had found the power to save herself from War. She glanced round quickly, realizing she'd turned her back on the betrayer. But whatever whammy Desire had slapped War with still had Jason blinking and shaking. Yes, it was Jason, she realized, chiefly because he'd returned to his normal human size. Desire, the memories, and the mindset of the incarnation who'd possessed her were unbelievable. Inconceivable, really. Feeling so intense, so beyond her experience, she didn't know what to think. Devotion, curiosity, clarity, and erotic desire. Erotic and downright scandalous. Of course, to Desire, scandal was a word significant only to mortals. Seeing things simultaneously as Desire and as Catherine Manners was like double vision. A splitting headache threatened to descend on her with each heartbeat. She dismissed Desire's memories, physically flinching back. To do otherwise risked insanity. Maybe that's what had happened to Jason, when Jason merged with war and gained war's memories of battles, stratagems, and strife going back thousands of years, he'd lost his mind. Maybe she should strip the ring of desire off her finger and throw it in that pit that Gamma had shown them. But the ring had also become her spirit focus when she translated into Ardeen, and the outline of a plan that came to her right then required that she keep it, and fucking hell, keep desire too. "Raoul," she said, "I can save you, or at least keep you safe until we figure something out. Listen, curl into my ring like Darneth. He's gone. There's a place for you. Will you do that? Can you?" For many long seconds, Raoul's shade did nothing. The expressions of life no longer flickered across his face. Micro-expressions, tells, all the body language a living creature communicated simply by being physically present were absent in Raoul's shade. She had no idea what he was thinking, or if he was thinking. Was he confused? Why didn't he listen? "Raoul, we don't have time, please." She offered the back of her hand, as if he was a gentleman in a period piece who would take it and lightly brush his lips. Instead, Raoul's uncertain outline melted into so much swirling vapor. He smoked into the ring. Chapter 29 Emancipation. Carter Morrison. In stories, especially novels and on TV, the main character is always getting knocked out or even fainting. In reality, it's really hard to knock unconscious a healthy adult unless you've come dangerously close to killing the poor bastard or inflicting permanent brain damage. If you've beaten someone so badly that they go into a coma, well, figure it out for yourself. On the other hand, after being punched in the back of my head by a golem, it's sort of surprising my skull wasn't crushed like an egg. Then I would have been unconscious just long enough for my brain to completely starve from lack of oxygen. By mere fact, I was able to consider it, it was obvious I'd escaped that outcome. What I'm trying to say is that, for the record, I didn't go unconscious. But fuck if it didn't hurt. Pretty much I was a puking, mewling mess, barely able to move my fingers. Resisting wasn't an option when they dragged me and Siraja into that crack at the bottom of the crater. Plus, I was bleeding. A lot. Apparently that was something they had right in stories. Head wounds bleed like the promise of no more tomorrows. A coppery, sweet taste in my mouth sickened me, so I spit, but avoided actually retching. Much. Wiping my mouth was impossible, because iron manacles pinched my wrists and clanked tight when I tried. My arms were stretched above my head. While not being unconscious, I blearily recalled being dumped in some sort of cage. Scooting myself closer to the bars provided enough slack in the chains so I could sit up straight. The ache in my head threatened to split it open, and nausea followed. I gasped, waiting for the dizziness to recede. When it finally did, the awfulness of my situation was fully revealed. Rather than a cage, I was in a cell, one of several sunk into the stone around the edge of some larger, cavernous chamber. The restraining bars were embedded in the solid stone. There were some standalone cages, too, hanging from the rocky ceiling. A large area between the cages held a massive sculpture resembling some kind of mythological flying beast. Light spilled from its interior, flickering from several fist-sized holes piercing its side. A muttering buzz also issued from the object, which reminded me of thousands of roaches swarming over each other. The cells held prisoners besides me. The closest was Siraja. She sat, hands bound behind her, facing the main chamber and the buzzing statue, manacles secured to the bars. She turned her head and blinked at me a few times, but offered no audible comment. The leather armor I'd grown accustomed seeing her in was absent. My own outerwear was missing, too. As was Jusher. Crap! "Are you all right?" I asked the Kephlem. Saraja gave a cautious nod, but remained quiet. Her eyes and ears flicked from me back to the main open area containing the cages. My talent whispered to me that she was indeed hale, save for a few bruises and an all-consuming anxiety. She was much healthier than me, in fact. My head was foggy and simultaneously felt as if it was in a vice, probably a concussion. A stabbing feeling near my abdomen, whenever I shifted, meant some bruised or even busted ribs. Could there be some internal damage? Best not to think about that, I decided. If someone hadn't relieved me of Jusher, I would have asked it what to do, though I bet the sanctimonious thing would tell me to see to my own wounds. If I could break a rope or mend it by naming it, it would tell me that I could rend flesh or repair it, too, even if it was my own. Easy for it to say. Although imaginary Jusher had a point. After all, the sphere was a product of my own creation and will, as most things here in Ardeen were. Even if it had all grown far more real than anything I could have ever imagined when I'd started coding the land of the curse so many years ago. Anyway, according to the context of this place, all I needed was a name to conjure with, and I knew my own name. Carter Morrison, I whispered to myself. The words burned my lips as the sound emerged, then spread until I was engulfed in a conflagration of sensation. It wasn't exactly searing pain, though not far off. A yelp escaped me as what felt like fire seared my skin. I'd just made my final, most lethal mistake. Then cool relief followed. There was no burning, no bonfire with me as the kindling, nor any hint of the pain from broken ribs, the foggy feeling from the concussion, or any other hurt. Huh. Flush with success, and perhaps slightly high from the sensation of perfect health still tingling from the tip of my head to my toes, I named the manacles, loosening them so they fell off, and then next, cell door lock, triggering it open. Whoa! Carter, hissed Saraja. Hold on, I said, and ambled over to the winged vessel and glanced into one of the many vents. Okay, not roaches. Tiny little lizards, each burning like a red-hot ember in fire, scuttling over each other in some larger burnt object. Something vaguely human-shaped lay curled inside with a few blackened bones poking out. Oh, jeez, I croaked. Is that a person? A rough voice answered. If Mevish is the spy who stayed up on the rim when you descended, then no, she got away. We sacrificed this slave in her place. The speaker stepped around from the opposite side of the vessel. The tattooed, wrinkled face and white cloak of greeter, back in human form, smiled at me. He still clutched his bone flute, but had added a circle of white metal at his temples. A crown? You, I said. I'm witty like that. You have no power here, Namer. He pointed to the white circlet. This protects me from mental influence or attempts to compromise my loyalties. Not a crown, then, but something of power. What protects it? I said, as the circlet's name found me. Greeter frowned, even as I asked the metal to stretch so that it slipped off his head. It settled loosely around his neck. His first reaction, the same one he'd relied on when he'd ambushed us on the crater floor, was his downfall. If he'd just removed the circlet, he might have beat me. But that's not what he did. He triggered his apotheosis with a snarl. Greeter grew, but I held the circlet's size in place with a whisper, so that whatever magic the soul sorcerer used, it didn't affect the stiff band as it did his cloak and other equipment. A strangled growl became a gasping whisper as the massive white ape, scrabbling at his neck with oversized claws, stumbled about the cell-lined chamber, knocking into the free-hanging cages dangling from the ceiling. I scrambled back so I wasn't crushed underneath when the huge creature finally toppled over. The winged vessel wasn't so fortunate. The container overturned with a clatter, spilling scurrying fire lizards everywhere, as well as the charcoal body which broke into pieces. Saraja yelled, "Carter, you toad fondler, look what you've done!" Red embers, each a tiny creature, raced everywhere like ants when some dipshit kid kicks the colony over, except these things were each as hot as a poker. Turning, I hustled to Saraja's cell, jumping between momentary clear spots on the floor, between scrabbling red dots. Sudden sweat stung my eyes and dryness tightened my throat. The little bastards gave off a lot of heat. The little fucker sensed me, crawling after me as I closed on Saraja. There were too many to individually name. I could maybe tell a handful to run away, but hundreds of others would take that time to burn us into carbon footstools. I had the vague sense that had I been the Maker, I wouldn't have been bound by such a restriction, but the Maker, I was not. A handful of lizards spilled into the Keflum's cell. She leaned away from them, but her manacles kept her pinned essentially in place. The movement drew the fire lizard's attention, plus more still outside the cell, which gave me an idea. I shifted my attention to the toppled winged vessel. What was the shape supposed to represent? Memory kindled from art sketches I'd approved. It was in the crude likeness of a creature of Ardeen, a Dlama. A winged Lamassu I'd adapted from Sumerian myth for the land of the curse, and so I named it, but with a twist in the same way I had named Jusher, when I'd fashioned it from the refuse I'd found in the glass desert. Then I'd had time to create something lasting. For this, I needed something quick before Saraja and I were overwhelmed. Naming it, I told it to run as far and as fast as it could. The vessel jerked. Its ungainly limbs suddenly suffused with pseudo-life, struggling to right itself, wings spastically flapping in a crude approximation of something actually alive. The lizards near me and the Keflum responded and flowed towards the spectacle while we froze in place. The foe Dlama trundled away from me, seeming even larger now that it could move, drawing the fire lizards, despite that it had previously served as the vessel containing them. They were too stupid to care, or maybe they wanted revenge. The lead fire lizards in the wave leaped after the tottering statue, scorching its exterior, but otherwise having little effect. The thing dashed itself down the length of the dungeon and into the far wall, breaking through into a larger space. I felt the enchantment I'd awoken in it shatter as the statue disintegrated from the impact. The lizards apparently liked what they found in the chamber beyond because they didn't return the way they'd come. Then I heard distant cries of consternation from that direction. More soul sorcerers was my guess. Time to go. A few moments of fumbling with the mechanisms got Saraja out of her cell and manacles. The Keflum rubbed her wrists, keeping a wary eye on the new hole in the wall. No one yet appeared to backtrack the source of the ruckus. That would presumably soon change. "How many soul sorcerers do you suppose are creeping around down here?" I asked. Saraja shrugged. "The stories don't give good numbers. There can't be too many, because sooner or later they'd form factions and turn on each other. Whether it's 5 or 500, I vote we avoid meeting any more of our hosts." Of the three other exits to the prison other than the freshly smashed hole, one seemed sort of familiar. "They brought us in that way. How can you be sure? I was blindfolded and you were unconscious." I was not unconscious. I just had to rest my eyes. The Kephlem's ears waggled. She said, Then we should go the way you remember. You are too gracious, I said, grinning. First, we checked to make sure no one else was caged in the chamber.